the case.
And 105.3 New Orleans. I'm your host, DeAndrew, and tonight my guest is Ted Phillips. I also need to remind everyone that you also can listen to the UFO Paranormal Radio Network on your cell phone simply by dialing 704-631-4060 and entering the four-digit station ID code 2899. My guest tonight has spent countless hours researching and investigating UFO trace cases, and his files contain over 3,000 cases from 91 countries. Ted Phillips began investigating UFO reports in 1964, and he was a research associate of the late Dr. J. Allen Hynek from 1968 until 1986. Mr. Phillips was a member of a select team invited to meet with the UN or with the United Nations Secretary General at the UN in New York, along with Dr. Hynek, Dr. Vallee, and astronaut Gordon Cooper. Ted has been featured in numerous documentaries and has given presentations at several conferences, including the first International UFO Congress and the first MUFON Symposium. Ted will also be speaking at the second annual Mysteries of the Universe Conference, July 18, 2009, in Kansas City, Missouri. I am very pleased and honored to welcome Ted back to the program. And how are you doing this evening, Ted?
I'm doing good. Very good.
This upcoming conference there in Missouri, I don't think I've heard of that one quite before. That must have been one that got past my radar.
Yeah. Well, I was asked several months ago and to do that one, and it's always good. To get into Kansas City. Years ago, I used to live closer to Kansas City and did a lot of talk radio and conferences up there, and I just love the city. And we have another one in Chicago in a couple of weeks. And Chicago's, I think, my first love for large cities.
Can you kind of give us a little... Meet Kent of what you'll be speaking about at the Mysteries of the Universe Conference?
Yes. For many years, I've always talked about physical trace landing cases, and I recently formed a small team to actually insert ourselves into active UFO areas. And while the trace cases are still my very favorites, we've been researching seven active sites in Arkansas, Kentucky, and Missouri. And that's what I'll be speaking about. A couple of those sites are just incredible with all kinds of activity. And also have actually allowed me for the first time to see UFOs. And as you can imagine, that was quite a thrill after over 40 years of not seeing a UFO. And that's basically what I'll be speaking about up there.
It is always thrilling to get your first sight. It's quite an adrenaline rush.
Oh, it certainly is, and the very first sighting caught me quite unaware because the objects that we saw were so different from what I was sort of set up to see over the years. Not the classic metallic appearing discs or anything like that. So it was kind of a double shock.
I can relate. My first sighting, I didn't even see it first. My neighbor across the street did and yelled at me across the street, "Hey, you know, what's that?"
Yeah, I've heard that before.
One of the locations that you've been doing a lot of investigating on, and I've been following along as you and your team progress, is the Marley Woods.
Mm-hmm.
the lights there. Are you going to be spending a lot of time down there this summer, or just the team?
Yes, I will personally be there. That's my biggest thing in this whole business, is to be in the field and to be able to deal with things, especially in real time. And yes, I'll be there and the team. As a matter of fact, almost 24/7, as a couple of projects get underway in fairly short order, that will allow us to be there, as I say, almost 24/7. So I'm very much looking forward to that. In the past, we've only been able to spend, perhaps a week at a time, and then sometimes 2 or 3 weeks before we can manage to get back. So there are periods where, in this tremendous activity, we're missing a lot. And I don't like that. I don't like to miss any of this stuff if I can help it. And it will be at Marley, and it also will be at 3 additional sites.
3 additional sites?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Want to give us a hint of where they're at? Or is it hush-hush secret?
Well, that's the problem. And, you know, one thing I've always been way in favor of is to make the information available to the public and to other researchers. Cases don't do you a lot of good if they're sitting in a file cabinet. So it's, in a way, painful that we can't reveal the site locations or, of course, witnesses' names at their request. And, of course, you, I think, well know the reason for that.
And oh, yeah.
It's, and that's becoming, I shouldn't call it a problem. It's sort of a public relations problem because people like to know, well, at least where is it? And so what we do is we get the data out there, and which is the best we can do right now. I'm hoping down the line we'll be able to pretty much reveal everything because it really goes against everything I believe in not to. But I would rather have the sightings than not to have them. So we have to do that. We have a couple of new and tremendously active sites. Of course, not their real names, and I was very careful to find that there were no places with these names. But one site we call Alta Spring, and the other is Fran Sim. And we'll be spending a lot of time there because the activity has picked up, and the sort of activity is actually very close approaches, and that's what we're really interested in. As a matter of fact, about 3 weeks ago, I was standing out by an old barn talking to my wife on the cell phone about 11 o'clock in the evening. And all of a sudden, in a dense timber, about 60, 70 feet away, I saw two headlight-sized lights moving along about 3 feet apart and about 2 to 3 feet above the ground. And they maintained the same relative distance and angle from each other, almost as though they were attached. But I soon found that they weren't attached because I could see them moving in and around tree trunks, and several times they actually were separated by a tree trunk. And so here I am talking to my wife, and I'm watching these things, and I watched them for almost 2 minutes, and the interesting thing is the color and the light. It's unlike anything I've ever seen before. In that it's white, but not a pure white. It has a sort of yellowish tinge, and the light is not bright. The thing I would liken them to would be if you could go back and see a couple of headlights on an automobile back in 1930, when, of course, the headlights were much dimmer. And that's exactly what they looked like, and they didn't brighten nor diminish at any time. There was no sound, although there was a very high wind, so I couldn't have heard a sound, I don't think, unless it was pretty sharp. And the interesting thing was that, again, these were about 4 inches or so in diameter, very sharply outlined. And the really cool thing is that they were moving due north, and out of the north, they were moving into a 30 to 40 mile an hour wind. And they were not bobbing and weaving. In other words, the flight was very stable. So we're talking about a great deal of power, of energy, to keep these things moving. And that it was almost like watching something glide on ice. And yet they're going into a very powerful headwind.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah. And, of course, I didn't have a camera. And I have a
BlackBerry.
Isn't that
typical?
Well, and I try. You know, when I'm in those sites, of course, I try to always carry some kind of photographic equipment. And there's only one small area where you can pick up a phone signal. So I thought, well, I'll run out here and be sure everything's okay at home. And so there I was with nothing but the BlackBerry, which has no phone, or no camera. And so I was pretty sick about that, because these would have been some great photos. But we've seen those a number of times. They're actually visible quite often. And recently they were seen in one small field, on three consecutive nights, each time at about 11 o'clock at night. And they were very low to the ground, and they were on each evening visible for 15 to 25 minutes.
Wow.
So that's where we're setting up camp on the next trip, which is going to be Tuesday.
Well, I've been doing some digging and reading up and research on early attempts. We're talking like 49, early 50s,
mm-hmm.
of early detection, I guess you could call it, of UFOs.
Yes.
And that got me wondering, what kind of equipment, surveillance equipment, or whatever you want to call it, that you guys use out there at Marley Wood?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, terrific question. And what we're most interested in at this time is the light spectrum of any of the activity, to try to get a better handle on the type of light we're looking at and what it might be made up of, and also in the electromagnetic fields that they produce. And even the small light balls produce enough EM field that they have stopped automobile engines, and which takes a substantial field. And also, we've even had cases where one of these small light balls was outside a building, and very close to the building, and a couple of witnesses inside looking out the window at it. And as they're standing there looking, some Christmas tree lights came on in the room. And during the time the light was close, these Christmas lights were just glowing away. And when it moved away, they went out. And immediately they went to the Christmas lights, and they weren't plugged in to anything. So that's considerable energy. And so we're heavily concentrating on the spectrum and on the type of energy that they emit. And that also goes for other types of lights, large lights that are seen in these sites. And as our projects get underway here shortly, we'll be getting much more advanced equipment, and I think we'll come up with some very interesting data over this year.
So are you, by chance, using any form of radiation detection or EM field sensors?
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have portable EM field meters, and we have, radiation detectors of several types. And radiation we have not been able to get. There is no generation, and I also found that in all these trace cases. The first trace case that I have in the file took place in 1490, and of course they didn't have any radiation monitors back then, but in all those cases coming up from that point in time to the current, where the object actually makes ground contact and affects the soil, plants, whatever, we have not been able to detect any meaningful radiation. And actually, the number is about 0.5% of these nearly 4,000 cases. So it doesn't happen often. And it doesn't seem to happen at all in the past 15 years or so. So, of course, we always carry that kind of monitoring equipment. Just in case we get, you know, one of the random events. But we're looking into, in these sites, we're looking into what we call large amber objects, which are very bright and yet not hurtful to the eyes. It's a, if it makes any sense, a soft, very bright appearance. And the color is truly dramatic and different. Again, colors I've not seen before, and no one on the team has. The reason we call them ambers is the color. Sort of an orangey-yellowish mixture of color. And most of the things are oval in a vertical sense. In other words, narrower than high. And I had the opportunity to see five of those at pretty close range in bright twilight, so I got a really good look at them for over a minute. And the closest object was the number five object, and it appeared to be about 8 feet wide and about 12 feet high. And there was a around the outer edge of this thing a narrow purplish colored band of light, which formed sort of a U configuration around the outside edge of the object with the top open, no band there. And I hate to admit it, because a few years ago I wasn't much on things like portals and events like that, because I'd always dealt with nuts and bolts sort of things. And I have to admit that my brain, as I watched this close one, was telling me something might come out of it. So that it was quite a mind-changing experience for me. And fortunately, it was also seen by five other witnesses. So that made me feel a little better.
Cool. That's neat. I mean, some of the stuff, you know, I've seen some of the videos on your website of mm-hmm. some of these lights, and they're just amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, quite extraordinary. And we just had, haven't put it on the website yet because we're studying this thing. And I should point out at this point that we have taken all of the Marley Woods stuff off the website for a short period of time, and the reason being we're changing to a much less expensive server situation, and we're updating the way we deal with reports from those areas. And so anyone that tunes in, keep tuning in, because eventually we'll have a lot of really good stuff back on these active sites, including photos and video. But in the video area, we have actually several hours. Some of the witnesses who are ranchers, farmers, lawyers, just the normal run of folks, since this all began in December of 1998, went out, bought video cameras, and taped a great deal of the activity for the past 10 years. And I've been going there for almost 10 years, of course, doing my part of taping. But so we have lots of very, very interesting video and still images. But last October, a family of four saw two of the small white light balls. They were about the size of basketballs. And they flew into the area first at a distance of about 100 feet. And then they moved to within about 40 feet of these this family of four. And the wife was videotaping all of it. And they got about 15 minutes of extraordinary video. And it is absolutely the clearest and best look at the light balls that I've ever had. And you can, we'll be putting up some of the stills when we get that back up on the website, but instead of just being a light, they are two very dynamic devices. That's all I can reasonably call them, which are generally circular in nature. There's a very intense light source at the nucleus, and then coming out from that, surrounding the bright area, is a very dynamic and influx, almost cloud-like material that in each frame, a 30th of a second, is constantly changing its shape and color and form. So it's just a tremendous jump forward, because now we have a much better idea as far as capturing this stuff with imagery and more of what we're looking at and a little more of what's going on with them. So it's fascinating, and it's you know, it's the high point in my life, although I've been fortunate enough to investigate some tremendously interesting landing cases, to be able to actually personally see these things in a close range. And we've had some of the witnesses within the object would come at them, actually come toward them, and stop at a point 2 feet in front of their face, directly in front of their face, and just hang there, and then go back to their original position. So we have found that without question there is intelligence involved, even in the very small objects. Now, I'm not saying anyone's riding inside a headlight-sized object, but obviously they have either self-intelligence or they're being obviously controlled, and they do react to things going on in their immediate surroundings. So that makes it all the more interesting. It's really fascinating stuff.
On any of these incidences where these things have, like you said, just describing, hanging like 2 feet in front of a person's face,
mm-hmm.
Now this may sound kind of like an act of stupidity, but has anybody actually tried to reach out and touch one of these things?
You know, actually, one of my dumber ideas, I think, was to actually get close enough to try to stop it somehow. Then I saw this recent close and very detailed video, and I would certainly suggest that one not try to make physical contact with the things, because visually they appear to have a tremendous amount of energy. And my impression in watching this video is that if they got any closer than a couple of feet, they could do you a lot of harm. I mean, electrically or by some power source. And so far, no one has actually tried to do that. And I think what it comes down to in talking with those witnesses is they're so totally startled by something that weird coming that close to them, and especially directly in front of your face. That's pretty intimidating, and I actually believe, based on the circumstances, that was the purpose for coming that close, because in the instances where that has happened, the witnesses would be quite angry. For example, in one case, one of these actually descended to within 2 feet of the face of a 12-year-old girl, and her mother was there, and the girl was just beside herself and shaking with fear, and the mother was instantly angered by the fact that this thing was that close and could actually have harmed the girl. And just after that happened, she and three others saw three of these things hanging in a triangular pattern very near the ground, and she headed for them, and she was screaming and waving her fist and challenging the things, you know, okay, come on, try that with me. And all the rest of the people were saying, you know, that's not a good idea. And suddenly the lower object in an instant went from a point about 400 feet from her to right in front of her face and was stationary there in the wink of an eye. And it just was hanging there for several seconds, instantly went back and rejoined the triangular formation, and she just kept going, and it did it a second time. And finally then she stopped, and it went back and rejoined the other two, and they disappeared at tremendous speed. So I think you have to call that a reaction and possibly an act of intimidation. You know, stop it. You've done this long enough. So, you know, that opens up a can of worms as to what these things are and how they're controlled and why they're doing what they do.
I'm just the kind of adventurous person that I probably would reach out and try to touch one.
You know, I have always thought that, and it would depend on the circumstances, because my goal is to get that close, simply to be able, if nothing else, to observe and hopefully photograph the things. But I don't know. After seeing some of this, I would be a little reluctant to try to touch it. And I told the guys, I said, well, maybe we should get a large butterfly net. And we, after watching the video, we all decided, well, that probably wouldn't do much. So,
one of our participants in our virtual auditorium here in Palpac commented on what I was saying about that. I was just silly enough to try and touch it. Paul Dwarf posted in here saying, tag it and it'll tag you.
Uh-huh. You know, that's a very good way to put it. I really, and you know, just very few years ago, I was so caught up in looking for one of these things landing, I mean, not to find it on the ground, but to go there and find anything from an oil leak to anything else physical, a bolt that had fallen off or whatever, because I totally believed, I still do, at least in those days, that the objects were real physical constructed machines, and they were absolutely physical, at least at some points in their existence. Now, I have no idea what they do once they leave the ground. But the reason I say that is I found in investigating many of these landing sites imprints from the landing pads. The things would either land on three legs or four legs, generally described as metallic structured type legs, and where the foot pads of those legs had gone into the ground, we were able to do compaction testing on the soil, and found that one type of object weighed between 7 and 10 tons, and a larger type object weighed between 10 and 14 tons. So that's a massive object, and that's a real object to do that. And I've actually even seen small human-like footprints. And compression on those indicated that whatever left the footprints weighed on the order of 60 pounds, which would conform to the many cases of three-foot guys with thin, spindly bodies. So, but in those days, that's what I was looking for, and a piece of anything that we could take into a laboratory and analyze and try to learn more about it. And I didn't, I let a lot of these good cases that were kind of outside the box go by me. And now, knowing what I know and having seen what I've seen, I wish I had paid a lot more attention to the other things going on. But in 68, Alan Hynek asked me one evening, you know, if I would concentrate on just the cases where the things land and do something to the ground, leave some kind of physical residue or whatever. And so who was I to turn down J. Allen Hynek? And I said, yeah, I'll be glad to do that. And so I stuck with it, and it's still my specialty. But the landing trace cases have fallen off dramatically in the past 15, 20 years. And if I had stuck totally with those kind of cases, no others, I would be dozing a lot, because there's not much going on. But now the larger metallic disks or oval configured objects, 18, 20 feet in diameter, 35 feet in diameter, those have almost stopped in being reported or seen. And what is replacing them, and has been since about 95, are these smaller objects, the lights, and in a few cases metallic discs, a very small size. So there's quite a change that's taken place, and I'll be speaking about that to some extent in Kansas City. So
it is
to be able to actually see a very dramatic change in what's happening. And I noticed some of the other researchers who look more at the overall picture are beginning to recognize that also.
Some of the other stuff I've been digging into lately has been the Foo Fighters World War II.
Yes.
And it seems to me that a lot of the descriptions that the pilots gave of the Foo Fighters kind of fits what's been going on in the Marley Woods area.
Yeah, I'm glad someone noticed that. Yes, it totally is. And I've always been interested in the World War II sightings, because they, of course, predated the general public knowledge of flying saucers. And it was a time when there was no such thing as flying saucers. And also, the very first case in which I was able to talk to an actual witness was my father introduced me to a World War II pilot when I was 12 years old. And so I listened to his story, and he was flying with a wing of night intruder bombers, meaning they were on a bombing run at night. And he said the entire wing, which was a large wing of bombers with full crews, all observed a not very large white light, circular light, that flew directly over the bombers. And these large planes were actually bobbed around a little bit by an air disturbance as it went over. And instantly, he said, it, without stopping, reversed directions, which is physically impossible even today, and flew under the bombers, and they were rocked again. And so that really grabbed me, really got me interested in this stuff. And a few years later, when I was involved with Alan Hynek, the same pilot had been getting all the names of the other pilots, the bomber numbers, the crew names and everything, and sent me all that information so I would have a complete report. So, yes, that's exactly. And, you know, the fun thing is after World War II, the Germans were amazed because they figured they were ours. And we were amazed because we assumed they were German.
And, or Japanese.
What was going on there? Well, we know there have been sightings dating on back, a number of good landing cases on back into the 20s, even around 1900, and quite a number of interesting observations in the 1800s, 1700s. But unfortunately, you can't get the credibility level with those because there's no way to talk to the witnesses and establish the credibility of the event. But there's enough of them that we have to consider that this stuff's been going on for quite a long while.
The only thing I can think of to explain what these things are is some kind of a possibly artificial intelligence or remote-controlled observance probe to see what us funny little humans are doing down here on this little dirt ball.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. I've formed the opinion over the last, probably 5 years, that these small objects are monitors of some kind. So consequently, they have a purpose. They're not just some random occurrence. And a lot of people like to tag these things as gas balls, plasma balls, and so on. Well, you can very quickly eliminate that theory, or those theories, because they're seen for far too long, and they are bright, and they do affect things in their immediate surroundings with a high EM field, and they do burn trees, leaves, limbs. They do rip off upper tree limbs, creating somewhat of a physical sight and physical evidence. And they do something that plasma and earthlights couldn't possibly do, and that is they react. And they show curiosity about a number of things, especially automobiles and humans. And I'm not trying to be funny here, but they do seem to have a great interest in cattle. So, and we've had quite a number of those cases. So it's rather amazing. But these, I do believe, they are, I don't know if they're on a sort of survey mission or if they're monitoring the plant life, life in general, atmosphere, whatever, maybe all that. But they either they have curiosity or they're programmed to have curiosity in the way that they will actually come out of the bushes to come close to people and animals and vehicles.
That's the first I've heard of them reacting to livestock. That kind of, of course, immediately when you said cattle, the first thing that popped in my mind was cattle mutilation. Have they been experiencing that in that area?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah. And it's quite amazing stuff. That's another aspect of all this. You know, I've always thought, well, let's don't try to tie in everything that's odd with flying saucers, but meaning the mutilations and some of those things. But when you're face-to-face with it and you can see what is sort of going on, one of the baseline things that we have for our active sites is the ranch in Utah, Skinwalker. And these sites are so similar to Skinwalker, it's a bit creepy. And we're over the years gradually seeing most of the same things that were observed scientifically in Skinwalker. And so I don't know why there would be specific areas where this would be prevalent. We've done a lot of looking at the geology of these sites. Anything whatsoever that might set that land apart from my backyard. And there's nothing that we've been able to find so far. Nothing in the area of minerals, geology, terrain, and so on. And the thing that I keep thinking in my mind, how unique those areas are, is that I could stand in my backyard, which is way out in the country, for the rest of my life, and I would bet any amount of money that I would never see any of this stuff. I've never seen any of it from my backyard, and yet you can go to these areas, and at least at some point in time, Skinwalker, and if you're there a week, you're going to see something. And so
Skinwalker, isn't that the one that's out, the ranch that's out in, I believe it's the San Luis Valley in Colorado?
No, Skinwalker is in Utah. Yeah, there is the ranch in Colorado. And I'm glad you brought that up, because that is yet a third area where similar things have happened. And it was very, very active and very much going on. And during a period of time, I believe it was through the 70s and into the 80s. Now, I'm trying to find out if anything still goes on there. It would be very interesting, you know, to do comparative studies between Skinwalker and the Colorado Ranch and our sites to see just how similar these events are. So, but yeah, the Colorado Ranch had a lot of very, very unusual things going on, and a very good old friend of mine, Leo Sprinkle, and Timothy Good, did a great deal of research on the Colorado Ranch, and I have a copy of Leo's report on his studies, and also Timothy just sent me a book, one of his books, which has a lot on that. So it's fascinating to be able to sit there and read from another area and see the comparisons. It's incredible, really is. And it gives us something to look for. You know, it gives us a baseline to work from and puts us a couple of steps ahead, because we kind of know what to expect next, although it doesn't seem you can ever figure out exactly what next, and that makes it kind of exciting. Even at my old age, I'm as passionate about this stuff as I've ever been.
I can relate on that. In fact, I think I'm a little more passionate about it now than I was, you know, 8-9 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
On the Marley Woods active areas, how big of an area are we talking here? Is it just a few acres or a few square miles? Or
yeah, it's basically east to west. It's about just under a mile, and north to south about a mile and a half. And then we have the three additional sites, which we just learned of in the last year, which are 15 miles to one, about 20 miles to the other, and about 20 miles to the third. So they're in the general vicinity, but separate.
Are they in like a straight line, or?
Mm-mm.
Is there any kind of a pattern to the location?
You know, there's not. And the terrain is a bit different between all of these sites. There is no straight line connecting the dots between them. And at this point, we can't see really where there is any pattern of any kind as far as their locations. And it is interesting at the Alta Springs site, we have located witnesses who saw this stuff as far back as the 1940s.
And, oh, wow.
Yeah, they would actually gather on at farms on hills and watch this stuff going on. And so that's fascinating. And the oldest report that we've been able to document in the Marley area is 1937. So that's quite a long period of time.
Long history of activity in that area.
Right, yeah. And that's an additional thing that we're doing discreetly, because we don't want to get anything going that where people are frightened or any chance that the location is going to be found. We do very quietly go out occasionally and talk to people, knock on doors. And generally, I've been a cave explorer since I was 14. So anytime we find a cave, we always have a little recreation and do that. And not only that, we're interested in the underground in the area. And so we'll just go to a house out in the boonies and start out a conversation with, we hear there's a cave in this area, and get them comfortable and where they can kind of trust us. And then, you know, hey, have you ever seen any of these odd lights? Because, you know, we saw something last night, which is not lying to the people at all, but you have to, you know, people are so afraid of public exposure in this stuff. And the reason is, initially, the Air Force primarily and the government ridiculed people to a point where they didn't want to be associated with it. And now, in the past few years, the media has pretty much killed the chance of individuals wanting to be exposed to ridicule. And I can't say too much about the documentaries generally are what disturbed me, because they all have the farm family, a guy, his wife, and 10 kids, and they describe what they just saw at close range, an excellent report, and they'll give them 20 seconds to tell their report. And then the next thing they bring on is a couple of skeptics and a psychologist with 20 minutes to tell these people why they're nuts, you know. Mm-hmm. And that aggravates me to no end. I've done some documentaries on the History Channel, and I just finished two shows with the UFO Hunters. And those shows, you know, they're constrained by time, and they can't take the long, long time, obviously, to stay in one area and pick up a lot of cases. But they're doing good, because they are keeping this stuff in the news, and they approach it very carefully. And so I had a lot of fun doing those. But the media in general has just, you know, watch any news sighting on cable TV network, anything, and they'll carry the story, but they'll always start, before they even get into the story, kind of chuckling, and, well, guess what we have now. So the audience is already predisposed to thinking, well, this is a big joke. And here we're trying to do something to increase the credibility of the subject. And so we have to protect the witnesses, because they don't have to talk to us, not for a second. They don't have to tell us a thing. And if they totally mistrust us, then we're not going to have any new data to work with at all. So it has to be handled very carefully.
Oh, I agree. Special that, now I can't think of his name. He passed away not long after it was aired. That's going to drive me crazy. It was a big news anchor man.
Oh, Peter Jennings.
Peter Jennings,
yes.
Thank you.
Yeah.
The way he covered it, the subject, was he put out a little information, you know, and it sounded like, well, you know, he's going to be reporting this straight up, no giggle factor, no ridicule factor, you know, just straight up info, and then he brought the debunkers in, and I lost all hope for that particular program.
Exactly. You describe it perfectly. I think the whole theory was to pull everybody in and keep them watching so they'd see all the sponsors, and then you just simply do a turnaround and slam the whole thing. And that's sad. You know, they don't have to do that. They don't have to approach it that way. And I don't have any problem with the skeptic that is on the fence. You know, if he's willing to consider both sides of the story, then I have no problem with it. I had a lot of long arguments with Phil Klass, and I finally wound up telling him at the end of one conversation on the phone to call me again because it was wasting our time. But for example, the skeptic on UFO hunters, he and I got to be, I think, decent friends, and I really respect his attitude because he's wanting to understand what's going on, and Kyle. And so I have no problem with that whatsoever. You know, we've got to prove our point, and they need to be a little more objective in how they try to prove theirs.
Yeah, Bill Klass was not my favorite person on the planet.
No.
He had a tendency to make a fool of himself to the extreme.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's true. And the problem is, though, the general public, you know, so many people have seen the goofy stuff, and that's the way they kind of look at it. They're very interested. And a lot of people are willing to change their mind. I've seen a lot of them change their mind. But when they keep seeing the goofy stuff, and they're not allowed really to see the hard stuff, the good stuff, that's the side they have to come up on. I mean, you can't blame the people at all.
This is true. And on that note, we need to take off and go to a break. We'll be back here in about 8 to 9 minutes. And we'll continue this conversation with Ted Phillips when we come back.
Welcome to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis. Now here's your host, Dee Andrew.
And welcome back to Eye to the Sky, UFO Synopsis, here on UFO Paranormal Radio Network, also broadcast live on UPRN 105.3 in New Orleans. I'm your host, Dee Andrew, and tonight we've been talking with Ted Phillips. Ted, just before we went, we were talking a bit about the Project Moonshaft.
Mm-hmm.
How has that been progressing?
Well, we're, of course, as always, waiting for more funding. We do have some funding that will allow us to do some things, but obviously what we, since it's a little far away in Slovakia, we have to get our hands on enough funding to get over there and to be there for a minimum of 6 weeks. And so that's the only holdup we have. Over all these years, I've been, for those that perhaps have never heard of it, I've only spent the last 37 years trying to get to a large and quite old artifact structure which is a couple of miles back in a very huge cave complex in the high Tatra Mountains of eastern Slovakia. And so we're I've pretty well backtracked the history of Antonin T. Hurok, who was an engineer hidden during World War II in that cave from the Nazis, and in looking for food, he went in search of bats, which doesn't strike me as a very tasty meal, but they hadn't had anything to eat for 4 days, and he finally came upon this enormous structure. And so we're we're ready to go. We're actually hoping that we'll get the additional funding so we can head that way in about mid-September of this year. And so we're quite excited if we can just get that last chunk of funding.
Oh, that would be wonderful. You'll have to keep us posted on it when you get to go.
Yes, and your listeners, if they're not familiar with it, can go on the website, ufophysical.com, and we have a lot of information, sketches and photographs, some of them actually from 1944 when he found this thing. It's a beautiful story. It really, he maintained a diary during World War II, and in 1970 I met him, Dr. Hynek and I met him, and discussed the artifact, and I actually not only got to see and handle his World War II diary, but photograph it. And so we have the only copies of the sketches, all the sketches that were in it. And interesting aside is that in 1970, after we became aware of it, Alan Hynek and I contacted Jim and Coral Lorenzen of then a very large UFO group, the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization, and they hooked me up with Jackie Gleason, the actor and comedian, and he was going to fund my first trip over there in late 1970. And the Russians had invaded Czechoslovakia in 68, had complete control, and they arrested and killed the only four contacts I had at that time in country. So we had to put it off, and it was then 1998 before I actually got to go there. So it's a terrific story, and I can kind of see perhaps a book one of these days.
Yes, several years ago, or a couple of years ago, it was at a conference in Laughlin, Nevada, and Grant Cameron and Larry Warren were talking about Jackie Gleason's interest in the subject of ufology and stories that circulated about him.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And Grant and I have done lectures at the same conference, and we discussed that very thing. And, yeah, Gleason was tremendously interested, and he knew a lot about UFOs.
Well, rumor has it that he had a rather large, extensive library of books on the subject.
Yes, yeah. Actually, that came up for auction. I think it was probably a year and a half, 2 years ago. Well, a year or a year and a half ago, I would say. And, yeah, he had an extensive collection. Yeah. Very nice man. Very intelligent guy.
You know, I've read the story that you have online about the moon shaft, or moon shaft, the
mm-hmm.
cave. Any idea what that is that's back there in that cave? Is it some kind of man-made chamber or a crater? craft or something?
Well, that is, I guess, now the $64 billion question. What it is, the Tony Hurok, in our conversation and in his diary, he speaks of sitting inside this thing. And this man was an extremely intelligent, well-educated guy. He had 4 degrees in engineering and linguistics. And he, in sitting there looking at it, and he had been in it every day for a little over a week, the week they were hidden in the cave, measuring, experimenting, trying to get samples of the material it is made of, this black, seamless, jet black, satiny material, so hard that a pickaxe wouldn't even scratch it. And actually, he fired his military rifle into the wall at a at an angle, which almost, of course, deafened him inside a cavern and inside the object itself. And all that did, a military rifle bullet, was send out green sparks and a very pungent odor, and no scratch, nothing. So the material is quite mysterious, and it seemed to be, as far as he could tell, a out of one piece. There were no seams, no connecting points, and it was shaped like a fat crescent moon and extended just off of vertical, about 12 degrees off of vertical, up and down like an enormous moon shaft. And that's why he called it that. And he said, as I'm sitting here, an intelligent and academically trained person, I cannot imagine, and I remember in 1944, what this thing is, who could have built it, and how it came to be inside a cave at this great depth. And so we're still at that point. The telling things about it, in his sketch of the outer wall, which, of course, first thing he saw, he was 2 miles back in the cave, went through a crawlway into a very large room, and across the room he could see this black expanse of exposed outer wall of the structure. And his sketch from 1944 diary is on the website. And he could see a small crack coming down diagonally along this wall. And he saw that as perhaps a means to get into this thing, or to take a look at the other side of this. And the interesting thing, the fascinating thing, is that the cave formation, flowstone and limestone, had formed a sort of framework around the outer portions of this thing, and as we all know, cave formations of that type take many, many, many thousands of years to form. So obviously the thing, based on that, had been there for way many thousands of years. So he took all his clothes off and wriggled through this crack and found that the wall had a thickness of 7 feet. And as he reached the other side, he rolled down an incline of limestone grippage and until he hit the back wall. Then he got his carbide light and torches relit, and he could see he was inside of this moon-shaped, crescent moon-shaped chamber. And the area he was standing on was limestone grippage and deposit that had built up, and he thought that was the floor of the structure. Well, over the period that he was in there, he took his military pickaxe and chopped away at the limestone until he broke through 60 inches of limestone deposit, which typically it'll vary by drippage, amount of rain, everything that's coming seepage into the cave. But it represents about 6,000 years. So that's inside this thing. We establish at least 6,000. Underneath the limestone, he finds a skeleton of a large animal. And he took three of the teeth from this animal. And after the war ended, he took it to a museum in the Ukraine. And the curator identified those teeth as prehistoric cave bear. So now we have this thing with 6,000 years of drippage. Beneath that, a prehistoric cave bear, which could go back perhaps a million years or even more. And beneath the cave bear, it was lying on a wavy, he said, constructed grill that went on down below where he could see. And he put his side of his head against this grill work, and he could feel warm air coming up from beneath. And he could hear a noise that he could relate to something like a large turbine running. And it was, he said, sounded like at a great depth below him. So we just flat have no idea until we can get to it and analyze the material and bring in the proper scientific types and figure out what this may or may not be. But it's also giving off an electromagnetic signal that we could pick up on the surface using an EM field meter and three compasses lying on the ground. We picked up 2-second pulses, a very steady 2-second pulsing from some point below. And we're, so to speak, still in the dark about what the thing might be. But whatever it is, it's very, very old and had to be constructed by someone.
Well, with using the compasses and EMF detectors, were you able to determine the size and or shape of this object?
Well, what happened was, is we were trying to locate the cave entrance, which is quite a job in itself. It's very small and not at all visible. It's situated in the ground and in the rocks in such a way that you almost have to fall against it to even find it. And the Slavic sheepman that took Hurok and his two soldiers and hid them in the cave always kept the entrance covered with stones because to him, he said, it was a sacred site. He never said why, although we found out later in the 70s that he had been taken into the cave back to the artifact by his father and grandfather in the 1930s. So he knew what was there, and he wanted to keep it hidden because he, in his mind, it was haunted and also a very sacred place because he didn't understand what he was looking at when he saw this thing, of course, as we don't even yet. But as we were trying to find the entrance, we kept going through this one area and working a grid back through there. It's very, very rugged country, densely forested and so on. And we would go through this one spot where cameras, walkie-talkies, anything with batteries would just stop working. And the third time through there, you know, I said, well, there's something, you know, we need to check this. And so we would take the field meter and compasses and go back and forth through the area. Well, it was a roughly circular area, about 25 feet in diameter. And I placed the EM field meter and the three compasses on the ground and then got outside of that 25-foot area, put the camcorder on a tripod, set it on telephoto of the instruments, and actually shot video quite an extraordinary thing to watch. So that's, you know, that's amazing. And this thing is about 1,700 feet below the top of the mountain.
Wow.
So, and when we got into the cave, I started surveying the passageway, and we couldn't get a great distance into it because after Tony was in there, the Russians had bombed the Germans in that area, and there's still huge bomb craters, and the bombs evidently had shaken some of the large stones in the cave loose, and it got back to a point where I had to actually hang upside down on a rope and be let down so I could look under a lot of this collapse and determine the passage did go on and actually did get larger. And it was headed, the entire cave that we were able to survey was headed basically in the direction of this high EM area. So whether it's actually connected or not, I don't know yet, but I think it's unusual because there would be nothing that I could imagine that would be pulsing EM signals in 2 second pulses in that area, because there's not even a human living anywhere within probably 11, 12 miles of that spot.
I have a quick question concerning this subject from another of our listeners in the Talcott Virtual Auditorium, Teresa Sheridan, who hosts Global Focus here on the same network.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think she heard your answer to this earlier, but I'll ask it for her again. She was wondering if you were going to Central Europe later this year on that particular dig.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we if we can get the additional funding, and we're sort of encouraged by a couple of prospects to fill out the funding that we need for equipment and everything. We are planning right now to leave for Slovakia in mid-September.
Cool.
Yeah.
I can't wait to find out what you guys find out about that.
Yeah.
I also have another question, but this is concerning the Marley Woods area, and I'm pretty sure I remember this incident that is referenced in this question. But Paul Dorf asks, I'm very curious about this older couple that you spoke of on earlier programs who were both knocked to the ground by some unseen force.
Yes.
Was there any trace evidence in that event besides the man's report from the hospital, footprints, radioactive areas, etc.? Has anything similar manifested in that area or to other people in other areas in the Marley Woods case?
That's a great question, and that's one of the really super cases from the area. There were no measurable effects, and the problem was we didn't learn of that because the people totally wouldn't talk about it, except the gentleman's wife, who was also knocked to the ground, told her best friend. And her best friend just happens to be another witness to other events and has become a good friend of mine. And she immediately told me, but it was 2 weeks after the event happened. And he was just getting out of the hospital. And so generally, any kind of residual EM effects or anything, any measurable effects, pretty well diminish in about 48 hours. That was found to be true at Skinwalker, and we're finding that true over at these sites. And so I can't really say. There may have been, if we could have gotten there right after it happened, but there were not only no footprints, but his wife initially was sitting in the car, and this was at noon on a bright, sunny, clear day, no winds, nothing, no storms, and she watched her husband walk from one of two buildings to the other, and there was very high grass there, and she saw him suddenly fall to the ground. She could see nothing around him, nothing above him, anywhere. And so when she then reached him, he was lying face down on the ground and bleeding profusely where his right leg had struck the ground. And she was then hit by two sharp blows from behind on her upper back, her shoulder. And later he told her that's exactly what had happened to him, and nothing was ever seen, nothing. And with reference to any other events similar to that, we have an entire category of what we call unseen forces, and obviously that falls into that category. And yes, there in one instance there was a four-wheel drive truck, very large, heavy tires, no engine, that was parked in a gravel driveway in front of a garage door about 12 feet back, and the three residents of the house, the glass on the front of their stereo shattered in a straight line and with a very loud noise, and right after that they hear a huge crashing sound, run out the front door, around the house, and back to the garage door, and this pickup, which was locked, had no engine, and the clutch and brake was locked, had been pushed 12 feet down that gravel driveway and tossed the tow bar, which was still hooked to it, through the garage door and across the garage, and you could see the grooves where the tires had not turned. And five of us then tried to push the truck, couldn't budge it an inch. And so there have been other events like that. The most recent and quite a striking thing was that where some of the mutilations have occurred, a rancher in daylight saw his herd of cattle in the field, and all of a sudden, they were sort of going into a tight group. He said as though something was herding that group into a very tight area, and then they were sort of pushed or herded into a corner, into two fences in the corner of the field, and held there by an invisible something for several minutes. And this was a herd of cattle that was so nervous and racked out about events that had been happening around them that they had to be sold and slaughtered, and because they couldn't be handled at all. So, in fact, yeah, there have been and there have been a couple of other instances where a great deal of force pushed down heavy steel gates. With no indentations, no impact marks, no scratches on two separate ranches. Those things have and do happen. Yes, they do.
Excuse me. I have another question here for you from a virtual auditorium. Gossamer777 asks, which trace case have you worked that has the most different pieces of trace evidence, all for the same event or landing?
That's a really good question. Actually, let's see. I think I would have to, and I hate often to go back to this one, but it's such a significant case. One that happened in Delphos, Kansas, way out in the north central portion of Kansas, and the witness was tending his sheep and arrived home after dark, and he was out in a very dark area, had a flashlight, and he and his dog were feeding the sheep. Well, the dog wasn't nice, but anyway, suddenly hears a vibrating noise coming from behind a hog shed about 45 feet from him, and that area lights up, very intense light, and he said it sounded like an old washing machine out of sync and vibrating badly. And he sees this object about 8 foot by 10 foot in size, and it's stationary 5 feet above the ground, and the trees in the area where it was at were scattered, but it was a pretty tight area that it had maneuvered through to get to that point. It had broken off a tree limb, trace type 1, 8.5 feet above the ground. The tree limb had been turned and pulled downward, and it had originally extended out into the area where this object was. While the witness was standing there with his herd of sheep, the dog made not a sound, which is really incredible that he didn't bark or run or do something, and the sheep were standing absolutely still throughout the whole event, and the witness couldn't move. So there's an effect. And as he watched this thing from the base, he could see what looked like a aqueous or liquid luminous material falling from the base of the object toward the ground. Odd part, a foot above the ground, the stuff stopped. He couldn't visually see it contacting the ground, so there was a 1 foot space between the ground and the bottom of this luminous spray, and on the ground, under that spray, he could see developing a haze or a low fog developing on the ground in a circular configuration, and that eventually turned into an 8 foot ring of glowing soil. So there's another trace and effect. And as he watched the thing, it rocked back slightly, became much brighter, and started moving down through the scattered trees and made a sharp right turn, ascended over a low hog shed. The noise changed to a high-pitched whistling sound, and he immediately was blinded, couldn't see anything. No light spots in that total darkness. And he could hear the sound of the object slowly receding toward the south behind him. And as he recovered his vision, he then could move, and he ran to the house, yelled at his mother and father, and was trying to tell them what had just happened. They ran outside. They saw the object in the sky as a sort of a circular bright light, and could hear the sound. And so after it disappeared to the south, where it was seen by a police officer in Minneapolis, Kansas, about 8 miles south, as it flew overhead, then he and his parents ran around into this pitch-black shelter belt area where the object had been and saw the glowing 8-foot ring. So what you're looking at is a donut. The soil in the center of this was black and normal. There was a slight grooving effect, not actually grooved into the ground, but a separation, a line, on the west side of the ring that was not glowing. And so as they're standing there looking at this, his mother and father squatted down, and they both touched the soil. And as they touched it, it had a cratered, cool feel to it, and tiny little indentations they could feel with their fingers. And almost instantly, their fingers, both people, became numb. And it frightened his mother to the point that she brushed those fingers against her slacks on her leg, trying to get the stuff off. And that portion of her leg in about a 2-inch circular area became totally numb. And this was in 1970, and 1971. And to the last time that I talked to her, which was in 2007, that portion of her leg was still numb, and she couldn't feel, for example, the doctor sticking pins in it and so on. But the numbness in their hands lasted in Mr. Johnson's case for about 2 to 3 days, but he had very hardened, callous skin from farm work. His wife was a nurse, and she couldn't take pulses, couldn't feel pulses for about 2 weeks before that cleared up. And so as they're standing there worrying about their fingers, their son asks him, he says, "Mom, do we have any pictures in the camera?" And she says, "I don't know." So they all ran back to the house and dug the old Polaroid camera out of the closet, and the camera and flash, and this is important, were two separate pieces. And so she pulled the camera out. It had one picture left, and of color film, and they took it, but not the flash, and they went back out, and she took the only photo I've ever seen of a site where, well, first of all, it is that brightly luminous, and a picture taken within 5 minutes of the ascent of the object. And later, years later, and at the time, I asked her this about every time I saw her, when you were out there and you were looking at this glow, because I wanted to determine how bright the glow was, I said, could you see, was there enough light from the ring to see how to set the camera to take the photo? And she said, "Ted, you could have read a newspaper by the light." She said, "I could see every lever and button and everything on that camera brightly." And that's important because this photo was contested, of course, by Phil Klass. He said, "Oh, well, she just used a flash." And, of course, that doesn't explain how the soil became pure white in this circular configuration, or the numbing, or on and on and on. But Phil didn't worry a lot about facts. But time later, I got the camera and the same type film, and using a flash, and I created a 8-foot ring out of flour. The moon phase was exactly the same as when they took the picture and everything. And I shot a flash picture, and there is nothing resembling the original picture there. I mean, it is so obvious what a flash would have done that didn't happen on the picture. But to make this very long story as short as possible, in talking about different effects, the next morning, the sheriff and a couple of highway patrolmen were called. They came out. They shot a beautiful photograph of the ring in daylight. The soil was pure white, but only the ring surface, which was about 18 inches wide and formed this 8-foot circle. Soil in the middle was normal, and in this one area to the west was normal. And so when I got there and taking samples, I found this material to be absolutely bone dry, even though it had snowed the night before I got there, and I could just clear the snow off the surface of the ring, and it would be a very light brown and totally dry. I could melt snow in my hand, pour it onto that section of ring, and it would just bead up like it would on a freshly waxed automobile. And so there was no absorption by the ring material, and only the ring material. Everything around it, in the middle and so on, was muddy and very, very wet. And as I took samples, I found that this dehydration effect went 14 inches into the ground, which abruptly it ended at 14 inches. And again, only in the ring itself. And I learned that the next day, the highway patrolman and the sheriff saw the dog, which had accompanied the boy, running head-on into a wooden fence, head-on into a wooden barn, and refusing to even be coaxed into the ring area. And within a week or so, the dog started, one eye started swelling dramatically. And they took him to the vet. He lost the eye, but the vet extracted a long, thing that looked, the only thing I can think of even close to it would be a gigantic millipede. And it was, its body was just covered with tiny little tentacles or legs. It wasn't possible to tell. And that thing is still preserved in a sealed glass container. And we were never able to get it to analyze it. They didn't want, they were afraid to give it to me. And that's a whole nother story. But the boy was very frightened, and he remains to this day as a grown man, very concerned about it. And so you have all those effects. The tree limb along the flight path where the thing came in and left, a 7-inch tree was knocked to the ground, the trunk, 7 inches thick, whole tree knocked down, but there were no impact marks to be found on the tree. And no impact marks on the tree limb that was broken and down. So there were all kinds of effects in this case. And we had analysis done on the material, the soil, by as many labs as we could find to take it and do it. And it was found that Oak Ridge actually was able to use an electron transmission microscope, and on very tiny pieces of soil, they photographed a haze around the soil, which they said was a coating of something. So also they took photographs, higher magnification, the interior or substance of that coating material, and they found in it what they called icicles, tiny, I mean microscopically tiny, icicle-shaped structures that no one at Oak Ridge had ever seen before. And just after they got to that point, Dr. Hynek and I received letters from Oak Ridge, and the chief scientist there was a good friend of Alan's, and he said, due to a change in management, we can no longer analyze or work with this material. Of course, they never sent us samples back, and that's what we ran into on many of the really good trace cases. And you talk about frustrating, that's frustrating. And we had no funding to pay for the very exotic tests that were required to identify this substance. But whatever it was, it came out of the UFO and created this ring, which glowed, by the way, for 4 nights following the event, and was seen by quite a number of people in that little community. So as far as a case with a lot of effects and significant effects, that's a very good one. Sorry about taking so long to tell that story.
That's okay. Well, we have about 4 minutes left, so let's see if we can get one in real quick. This was from Sandman in our virtual auditorium, and he wants to know, what is your view of trace evidence, and what do you consider to be trace evidence?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, another good question. In the very beginning, we thought it would be pretty simple. When Alan said, okay, dig up all the old cases you can find and start investigating all of the new ones that take place. And pretty quickly, we found there were a lot more than we ever imagined. And at the very peak time for these cases, which was the late 1960s into the late 70s, we were actually getting a landing case with physical evidence every other day. Now, this is globally. Every other day. Now, that's a tremendous number of events. And so pretty soon I was finding that the sites varied in the types of traces that would be left. And basically what you're looking at, if you had, let's say, a Russian, very advanced Russian aircraft land in a field for a couple of minutes and take off, and you wanted to go in and learn everything you possibly could about how that was powered, the weight, every possible bit of maybe some fluid residue, so you know how the thing was powered, what kind of an engine, what kind of fuel. that's how we had to look at the landing cases. And long before CSI, that's actually what I was doing. And I would treat every landing site like a crime scene. And I would go in and I would take, unlike the TV shows, you don't solve it or you don't investigate it in a couple of hours. There are many times that I would spend days at one landing site, and you would find what I call physical evidence is something left behind, such as the residue that lit up that ring in Kansas. Something imprints where a physical object with mass makes impressions, compression on the ground. Where plants are burned by a flameless source of heat, and you keep finding over and over again, it's like you're dealing with a giant microwave oven. The same kind of effects, the dehydration, the heating from the inside out, and we kept finding that over and over. But a particular type of object would leave a particular type of traces. And so it wasn't very long into this, actually by 1971 from 68, I could go into a new case I knew really nothing about, talk to the witnesses without seeing the landing site, and they would describe the object to me and what it did, how it came in, how it left, and so on. And before I reached the landing site physically, I knew pretty well what I was going to find. They were that repetitive. And so I had no question in my mind that we were dealing with real physical objects, machines, devices, and that not based on my beliefs, but on the data itself, how they maneuvered around trees into areas, very tight areas. And the landing pads, the landing legs, would be configured by whoever built the thing to compensate on the terrain that they were landing on to keep the object absolutely level. So there was an intelligent process that was going on in the construction of these things. They were designed, well thought out, and much higher technology than anything we had at the time. And it's kind of sad that we've lost those nice big landing sites and the nice big objects, and we're now dealing with this what appears to be very shy, in a lot of cases, small lighted objects. And but it's been fascinating, and it totally convinced me in the reality of some UFOs, and I know of almost 4,000 that I'd put a lot of, I'd wage a lot of money on.
Unfortunately, we're out of time. did you give our audience your website address again?
Yes, the website is UFOphysical.com, UFOphysical.com.
And everybody be sure and catch Ted in Kansas City, July 18th, for the Mysteries of the Universe Conference there in Missouri, Kansas City, Missouri. And if you can attend, be sure and say hi to Ted. I'm sure he'd be happy to talk with you.
Absolutely.
And also this speaking engagement in Chicago, and where's that at?
It's at Eagle Ridge Resort in Galena, Illinois, just north of Chicago. And I would throw this in really quickly. I think one thing you'd enjoy, not so much my speaking, but the fact that I use generally 100 or more images and videos, so I'm not just standing up there putting you to sleep.
Awesome. Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have tonight. I'd like to thank everyone for tuning in, and also thank all those who joined us here in the Palpac Auditorium. And a very special thank you, Ted, for joining us tonight. I appreciate it very, very much.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it.
So stay tuned for Voice of the People, hosted by November Hansen. Her guest tonight will be author Scott Bloom. And please join us again next Saturday on UFO Paranormal Radio Network for another episode of Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, where my guest will be Larry Lowe. Until then, keep an eye to the sky. Good night, everyone.